Either you're still asleep from it, which is why you're in your chairs, or you've managed to come back for round two. And we're really on a rapid drive, as I explained, through the whole of the Christian life. There are all kinds of beauty spots we won't be able to stop and explore and view. And it's not kind of chocolate box cover, or at least those old chocolate box cover pictures, you know, where you just go ooh and ah at the scenery, because they're shot through with reality. As it comes. We saw earlier this morning good news for the weak Christian, the Christian who hasn't thrown off sin and become impervious to it, but is up to here battling with it. Verse 1, in the original, the emphasis is massive. It really goes like this. No now condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And for the Christian who's caught up in a broken world where death remains a living and active enemy snaring everyone, well, verse 11, he who raised Christ from the dead won't stop there. He'll also give life to your mortal bodies because of his spirit who lives in you, a future for dying Christians. No lack of reality, yet still a sure hope. Not surprisingly, therefore, when we get to verse 12, he starts like this. Therefore, brothers and sisters, we have an obligation. We owe God one. But not we owe God one in order to get right with him. We're to live right because we've been put right. Because we belong with God, because his spirit is at work in us. For, verse 14 begins, those who are led by the Spirit of God are the children of God. And you know, you don't self-identify as the children of God. Here, the children of God are those who are led by the Spirit of God. Now, that's a kind of phrase, isn't it, that we often use when we're talking about guidance. You know how, the Spirit led me to take this course, do this job, marry this person, and indeed he can, and indeed he does, but it's not actually quite what's being spoken about here. See, being led by the Spirit of God here means being led to do what is so unnatural back in verse 13. If you live according to the flesh, you'll die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the misdeeds of the body, you'll live. You put to death the misdeeds of the body. You're not out of the battle with our selfish natures, but we're in the thick of it. And it's ruthless as well. That's what life in the Spirit is like. Because it's only by the Spirit that you'll put to death the misdeeds of the body. And that's the mark of the children of God. They're the people who battle their selfish natures, who don't just say, well, what's the harm in looking at this stuff once? Or it's just a little lie. Or everyone else does it. Now, the Spirit means we put to death those ideas. But the battle's relentless, and every time we say no is a miracle. But look, into that situation, to those kind of people, the Spirit brings adoption. That's the first point here. Verse 14. For those who are led by the Spirit of God are the children of God. For, verse 15. Yeah, there's another little four that's slipped in there. The Spirit you received does not make you slaves so that you live in fear again. Who's always doing a job with one eye on the master to make sure he's still pleased? You know, doing the job, always wondering, am I in his good books? Who goes to bed at night never knowing if they'll belong in the morning? It's the slave, not the Christian. See, verse 15, you didn't receive a spirit of slavery. The Spirit you received does not make you slaves so that you live in fear again. But you received the Spirit of adoption. The Spirit you received brought about your adoption to sonship. John Wesley, you know, the great Methodist preacher, well, that's what Methodists like to say. I always remind them that he lived and died an Anglican, but that's another issue. John Wesley, when he was up at Oxford, he and a group of friends formed something they called the Holy Club. And really, it was trying to seek God by doing good deeds. When you look at what they got up to, it was remarkable, massively impressive. Some years later, he got converted. And as he reflected on his time at Oxford, he wrote this to his mother. He said, it may have been the religion of slaves, but it was certainly not the religion of sons. I think there's many a person before and after John Wesley who actually could reflect and discover that's what they've been living. The Christian doesn't work for a salary, but for a father. And some people sort of think these days, oh, adoption, that's rather sort of second best, second rate. There's nothing second rate about adoption. It was well known in the ancient world at all levels of society, you know, from the posh end as well as the bottom end. And it gave you immense rights. You were family. You know, Pete and Kate Boddington, they'd take pity on me, they'd adopt me. Immense changes for me. I get the Boddington name, you know, and his season ticket to whatever he's got a season ticket for, I can use. My debts are cancelled. The overdraft gone, the credit card's paid off. I get a new home. I can swap my slum for the palatial Boddington villa. I get a new family. I was treated as one of them, if my behaviour warrants it or not. And I become their heir. One day, the Boddington millions will be mine. That's what... So you better get earning. That's what adoption means. All of that. And it's like that when it comes to us and God. The Spirit brings me all that security as one of God's family. And that's what Christians receive. The Spirit brings adoption. Do you know that sense of being family with God? Well, here's one of the consequences. The Spirit gives confidence. Here's the second thing. Verse 15. See the end of it. By him, by the Spirit, we cry, Abba, Father. Jim Packer, the great theologian, was asked, what is a Christian? And he said, the richest answer is that a Christian is someone who has God for his father. He said, you sum up the whole of New Testament religion if you describe it as the knowledge of God as one's holy father. If you want to judge how well a person understands Christianity, find out how much they make of the thought of being God's child and having God as their father. If this is not the thought that prompts and controls their worship and prayers and their whole outlook on life, it means they don't understand Christianity very well at all. How much do you make of the thought of being God's child and having God as your father? Well, the Spirit's job is to bring me that privilege. By him we cry, Abba, Father. I was on a train the other week and... there was this Jewish family sort of sitting around one of those kind of table seats. Mum, dad, and three kids were in there, little ones. And halfway through the journey, as the kids were getting a bit restless and so on, I suddenly heard one of them calling out, Abba, 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 Daddy, Daddy. That's the word. It's what a child says of father. And the questions... I know quickly follow for some people. Can't we all call God Father? Well, no. Although he made each one of us, and in that sense we're his offspring, as Paul tells the Athenians in Acts 17, it's not the natural way for us to speak of God. It is an extraordinary New Testament privilege. One scholar searched Old Testament literature and other prayers of late Judaism for a trace of calling God Abba, and he found none. He summed it up. He said, no Jew would have dared to address God as his father in that manner. Hindus wouldn't either. 1,000 names for God, but father's not one of them. Not a word that springs readily from a Muslim's lips either. See, if God's speaking to us this morning, let his Spirit fill you with a fresh wonder at the thought of having God as your father, the fresh privilege of calling him Abba, my father. Someone else says, Hugh, it's not really a language for today's culture. I mean, there are too many broken homes and absent fathers, too much hurt and pain. Father speaks too often of bad experiences. And it's true. I understand that. But most people I speak to from that background, most people you read with that kind of history behind them, they know that what they have experienced is bad fathering. And we must let God and not our experience define fatherhood. I read a book by someone called Tori Danti, and she had a background of abuse by her father, sexual abuse. For many years. Her mother ignored it. The book was called, well, it was what her father used to say to her when he abused her. He said, "This is our little secret." It's a horrific title, really, when you think of it. And Tori eventually, as she grows up, gets in with her Christian friends and starts to feel her way towards a Christian faith. And as in her very sort of early days of a Christian faith, she goes along to a big sort of Christian house party conference thing called Soul Survivor. And she says, "I remember going to a seminar to hear someone speaking on the subject of Father God. The speaker compared God the Father with biological fathers. The two could be very different. And she described the ideal of fatherhood in ways which made me realize afresh just what a lousy father I had. I walked out. I couldn't listen to any more. My faith," she said, "was very mixed up. I could relate to the Jesus side of God. Jesus was like a friend. He made sense. But I wasn't ready to have another father in my life." Well, a couple of years on, as actually the whole abuse thing was now a legal case coming to trial, as she's preparing for it, she's reading the Psalms. And she reads Psalm 27, then she comes to Psalm 27, verse 10, and she says, "It spoke to me very powerfully. It said this, 'Even though my father and mother forsake me, the Lord will receive me.'" I could hardly believe what I was reading. It was as if those words had been written just for me. I read them time and time again, saying the words slowly over and over again to myself. "Even though my father and mother forsake me, the Lord will receive me." Yes, it was true, Tori went on. "I did feel my father and mother had abandoned me. But here, what God was telling me that he hadn't abandoned me. Quite the reverse. He would receive me. In other words, he would look after me in the days ahead. I wasn't alone then, and I wouldn't be alone in the future." The contrast between my father in heaven and my earthly parents is unbelievable. I still can't get over the wonder of realizing how much my heavenly father loves me and cares for me. I think many of us find that hard to believe at first, especially when we're not used to being loved and cherished by our own parents. I can certainly identify with people who feel that way. Yet knowing God as Father remains one of his greatest gifts and the Christian's greatest privilege. I wonder if we need to cherish it more. Look at the confidence this relationship brings the Christian. See, by him we cry, "Abba, Father." And it's not a cry of arrogance, you know, "I'm God's son." No, it's a cry of confidence. God is my father. And it's very different, isn't it, which way around you're taking that. It's not saying everyone who reads the Lord's Prayer off a service sheet, you know, "Our Father," can bask in the full confidence of a child of God. Remember the setting. It's written to us in our weakness, in the middle of that relentless struggle and war against sin. That's when you cry, "Abba, Father." It's not even so much ecstatic praise and a cozy chorus. It's the cry of the child out of depth in a struggle. And who do you shout out for? Dad. You remember the story of the prodigal son? when he's got his share of the inheritance ahead of time and he's lit off and he's splashed it all on who knows what, and he lands up in the pigsty and he comes to his senses. He's blown it, he's messed up. Who can you face when you're at your weakest, when you're at your worst, when there's egg all over your face? It's not really your mates, is it? It's Father. I'll go to my Father and say, Father, I've sinned against you. Is that you? Do you know what it is to be kind of drowning in the battle against temptation and to cry out, Father? It's more than just grit your teeth and fight. It's looking to the Father. The Spirit is at work when you do that. Take all the confidence from that. The Spirit brings adoption. The Spirit gives confidence. And if I don't know it, you know, I wonder whether I need to pray verse 16 that would be true for me. The Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are God's children. You know what it is when you're bringing up kids? Well, some of you will know what it is when you're bringing up kids and they're young kids. I wanted my children not just to be loved, but to know that they were loved. Not always the same thing, is it? And some of them, sort of, every time you've sort of sensed they knew they were loved, they leaked, and you had to kind of start again. They weren't very good. You kind of think, how many more times do I have to show you I love you? How many more times do I have to show you I love you? Yeah, it's an almost endless thing, isn't it? Well, God's like that as well. If you look at verse 16, it's not just that he loves us, but he wants us to know we're loved. He seems to speak here of a subjective experience, a hugely reassuring confidence. I was converted as a student. I understood virtually nothing of the Christian gospel. I was taken along to hear people, some of the best preachers in the land, explain the gospel to me. It went in this ear and straight out the other. Which is not hugely encouraging when you land up as a preacher yourself. But that was me. I was, you know, in terms of spiritual understanding, I was thick as two short planks. I got converted one night. The friend who used to bring me along to all of these things came home and had a cup of coffee with me in my student bedsit. And he said, Hugh, you've never really said, where do you stand with Christ? And I was shocked because... Actually, I was the only other person in the room, so you kind of had to answer the question. It's quite difficult, isn't it? The preachers, that could go over my head, but this one was here. So I sort of mumbled some kind of answer to him, and when he left, I remember kneeling by my bed, and praying. I have no idea what I prayed. I can't imagine it made any theological sense at all because I didn't have any theology to make sense of. But I prayed, and it was, if you like, in my spirit, it was reaching out to God. Conversion was so dramatic for me that I got into bed and went to sleep, the first thing I did as a Christian. But I did wake up, and the next morning I woke up and I knew I was a Christian. I'm a Christian. What do Christians do? Christians have Bibles. So I went out to the shop. I can take you to the shop on the high street there, which I knew had Bibles. And I bought a Bible. I bought a big black authorized version Bible. I could hardly understand it, but I got a Bible because I'm a Christian. And I knew I was a Christian, and I'm sure this was the Spirit testifying to my spirit. That I was God's child. It was the only way I could know. A few weeks later, some friend was talking to me about being a Christian and knowing I was a Christian. He sort of told me off and said I should be trusting in Bible verses, and that's how I should know I was a Christian. I said, how could I? I didn't know any of the Bible verses. So he actually showed me some Bible verses, that was great because I learned to trust them, and the Spirit reassured me that way too. In the thick of it all, as God holds us here, do we need to pray to His Spirit for this reassuring work? That the Spirit who brings adoption will give you confidence as a child of God. And there's more to come. See, here's something else you see in these passages. The Spirit brings adoption. The Spirit gives confidence. The Spirit guarantees the future. Now, as I look at this, I keep realizing how often my gospel stops at verse 16. I'm thrilled if someone's got to the position where they're led by the Spirit and assured they're children of God, and I think, fantastic, job done, and Paul's gospel doesn't stop there. See what he says in verse 17? Now, if we are children, then we're heirs. Heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ. If we're children, then we're heirs. That, by the way, is why it talked about as being adopted as sons and the adoption of sonship. Because in that culture, only males could inherit. And in the gospel, men and women inherit. So it talks about sonship, not because women are left out, but because it wants to make the point that women don't miss out. We're heirs of God. And even that isn't all. We are fellow heirs with Christ. What He has in store for me and for you, if we're in the Christian family, is what He has in store for Christ. It's that glory. So there's nothing second best about it for all my struggles now. The adopted child is treated just like the real child. Co-heirs with Christ. Yeah. If indeed we share in His sufferings, in order that we may also share in His glory. Co-heirs with Christ, share in His glory, same future, same glory, yeah, but same root there, sharing in His sufferings. The wearying struggles now of temptation, of physical hardship, the very opposite of glory, which I go through them because of my Christian belief now, they're actually signs I'm on the right road. There was a little piece on the BBC News last autumn in one of these kind of 100-year memories of the First World War of the fact that what soldiers were given in their kit included a New Testament, and how a number of soldiers were found dead on the battlefield clutching a New Testament in their hand. I've no doubt the reasons they were holding it. There was a spectrum from some, probably it was some kind of good luck thing. But for others, you feel sure it was actually a sign of real faith. The kind of people who'd read Romans 8 and knew there was a future. Holding their hope. You see, what an identity to be an adopted child of God. What a confidence to know God as my Father. What a future to be a fellow heir with Christ. I mean, that's belonging. That's an identity to die for. That's the Spirit's work. No guilt in life, no fear in death. Yeah, we thought of that earlier. It's amazing. And yet there is so much more. To be an adopted child of God. To know God as my Father. To be a fellow heir with Christ. I mean, what greater privilege can you want? What richer status can you have? What better hope can be ours? So why don't we just have a moment just to be quiet, to look afresh at these simple little sentences, to thank God for that hope. To ask God, if you need to give you that confidence. Let's be still.